Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your hoarse-voiced host. COVID has struck again, and Patricia Kohlberg, suitably distanced, is our producer. If we have a theme this morning, it'd be something like looking backward toward the future. Most notably, we'll celebrate the 30th anniversary of Oregon's Rural Organizing Project, an ongoing effort that links local groups across the state. For our celebration, Sidra Pearson, newest staff person at ROP, will join us for an ROP overview and to announce a retrospective exhibit, Bridging Divides, Defending Dignity in Your Community, coming to your community, wherever in the state you might be. We're also privileged to bring you some of the funny and moving and thoughtful celebration that took place at the end of August on the centennial of Howard Zinn's birth. We'll hear Zinn himself from an earlier recording and some poetry and reminiscence from Martin Espada about his relationship with Zinn. Thanks to Bill Bigelow, himself a speaker at the celebration, for suggesting these. And we'll hear a follow-up to Bill Resnick's discussion with Jeremy Brecher of the Labor Network for Sustainability. Their initial conversation a couple of weeks ago uncovered some disagreements between these environmental activists, disagreements they'll here attempt to sort out. Our music this morning, to complement our focus on the Rural Organizing Project, is from the Road Sodas, based in Summit, Oregon, in the Coast Range. It's called There May Be Hope. If you download it from the Road Sodas website, they say all profits from this album will go to supporting radical social and environmental justice organizing. Here's how their song begins.
A lot more people raising a ruckus, start making a fuss, start giving up, and get out into the streets, and there may be hope. There's a time and a place for peace, a time to be ready to bleed. There's a time to play nice and say please, but right now's the time for dismantling machinery. And there may be hope, maybe even for us. We need a lot more people raising a ruckus, start making a fuss, start giving up, and get out into the streets, and there may be hope.
We'll hear more of There May Be Hope. In line with our looking backward theme, there was an anniversary this past week I'd like to call to your attention. Thanks to Eduardo Galeano and his calendar of human history called Children of the Days. On September 28th, we celebrated the International Day for the Human Right to Information. Accurate information is at a premium right now in the politics of this country, but it's sometimes easier to make a point about the present by looking to the past. Did you know that after the United States used atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was no release of radioactivity at all in those razed cities? Are you surprised to learn that? That's at least what the New York Times reported for weeks after the bombing. Any reports to the contrary, the Times reassured its readers, were only, quote, the Japanese continuing their propaganda. In fact, the radioactivity was horrific and accounted for a major share of the human damage. But the reporter who wrote that blatant lie won the Pulitzer Prize as a result. Only some time later did someone uncover that the reporter was receiving two paychecks, one from the Times, another from the U.S. War Department. This could be the time for a plug about the independence and non-commercial nature of KBOO. If you've got that point, let's go to our interview with Sidra Pearson of the Rural Organizing Project. I want first to point out two corrections that need to be made to what Sidra and I say. She alertly caught both of these. Early on, she says that ROP has affiliate groups in every Oregon county. She meant nearly every county. Rural Organizing Project has a presence in all but two, which is wonderful. And late in the interview, I misstate the name of the 30th anniversary traveling exhibit. It's not Building Bridges. I was thinking of the long-running KABU program, Armando Puentes. The correct name is Bridging Divides. Here's this morning's feature, Another World is Possible, with ROP's Sidra Pearson. This morning, we're going to take a look at one of the institutions in Oregon that make me happy to be an Oregonian, and that is the Rural Organizing Project. That, along with KABU, of course, a couple of our prime and prized institutions. This is the 30th anniversary for the Rural Organizing Project, founded in 1992. There'll be an exhibit about it, traveling to your neighborhood, wherever in the state you are. And we're very pleased this morning to have a staff person from the Rural Organizing Project, Sidra Pearson, here with us. Sidra, welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Before we talk about ROP and its structure and how it decides on what issues to address and all those kind of big questions, I'm curious about you. Give us a little bit of background. And in particular, seems to me like you've got, in many ways, an ideal kind of position, an ideal kind of path for yourself, because you're in a position actually to make a difference and to sense that you're making a difference in the world. So is that the sense you have about yourself? And how did you come to decide on organizing as a direction?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I started organizing in high school, I think before I even knew to call it organizing. When I wound up in college and got introduced to a group of students who for a long time had been working on a climate justice campaign to get the college to stop investing their money in fossil fuels, I became a part of that campaign and really found a home in organizing and learned a lot from that experience. And one of the major learnings, I would say, is that there was so much power in that campaign because it was really focused in having a strong group that was fighting for this cause, not just a couple of individuals. And that was so important in the college setting, but really anywhere where you're going to have individual organizers moving on, moving away, having things come up. And in that campaign that was ultimately successful, I think a lot of that can be attributed to having a strong group that was continuously pulling in new people who were fired up and ready to get involved. So that was one of the things that was so exciting for me in finding the Rural Organizing Project, is that is a central part of our model is building up the power of local autonomous human dignity groups that are constantly growing. And because it's a group, they can be in it for the long haul.
Part of what you said, and it's an important point, is that you had some success too, that you were able to see that particular versions of organizing, particular ways of organizing can have success. Mm. And so fill us in a bit on the Rural Organizing Project. What is it? And then we'll get into some of the specifics, including some of the wonderful campaigns, both historically, but also now.
Yeah, let's start there. So the Rural Organizing Project is a statewide organization that supports a multi-issue, rural-centered grassroots base in Oregon. Right now, we consist of over 80 human dignity groups. And our mission is to strengthen the skills, resources, and vision of primary leadership in these local autonomous human dignity groups, with the goal of keeping those groups a vibrant source for a just democracy.
Now, what I remember from a recent gathering of ROP is that those 80 groups are spread out all over the state. That, if my recollection is correct, there were something like 25 different Oregon counties represented. Is that true at the recent strategy caucus?
Yes, our most recent rural caucus and strategy session. I don't know the numbers on how many of our counties are represented at that particular caucus, but we do have member groups in all counties across the state.
So ROP itself, how is it structured?
So the organization is our human dignity groups. That is the network. So we have a small team of staff organizers that is working to follow the lead of that local leadership and support them in their organizing. And then each human dignity group is completely autonomous and working on the issues that they have decided are most pressing and important in their communities. So some groups right now are organizing to protect inclusive library books and school curriculum. Many have organized protests around issues from Black Lives Matter to gun safety to reproductive justice. Still others are providing direct aid and support in the wake of disasters. And right now, many of our groups are talking to their neighbors about the upcoming election and voting our values.
And you have particular territory that you're responsible for in the state, you as a staff person. Is that true of every staff person for ROP?
Yeah, so each of our organizers on staff works most closely with local leadership in specific counties across the state. And that's so that we can be building up those relationships and making sure to meet with folks on person or in person when we're on the road.
If I heard you correctly, the issues adopted by the organization, the initiative and the impulse comes from the local groups.
Yes, that's correct. And that's been true since our founding. So in 1992, when our founder Marcy Westerling created the Rural Organizing Project, that came out of conversations traveling across the state to talk with folks about what was most important to them. And that was spurred by a ballot measure campaign, Ballot Measure 9 in 1992, that was a homophobic ballot measure trying to create second-class citizenship for gay and lesbian Oregonians. And Marcy and other leaders got to talking and felt that it was really important for rural folks to be included in the campaign to push back against this ballot measure. And so they started traveling the state and meeting with folks who wanted to get involved. And that's how a network of groups came to be ROP. So that model of local autonomous human dignity groups started there, and really with just sitting down and talking about the issues that matter.
Marcy's one of the people that I miss, of course. Departed Marcy. Another thing that you've just said, I'm reading into what you're saying, is that ROP, though, functions as well to spread the news among the different groups, that is possibly to spread campaigns. The initiative may come from the local groups, but then other local groups are made aware of people fighting around particular sets of issues and
Definitely. That's a big part of what we do is just sharing stories and highlighting some of the really amazing organizing that's going on so that groups can find out about other similar work that's going around across the state and break rural isolation. So part of how we do that is send out frequent newsletters, just lifting up the story of some of these autonomous human dignity groups and what they're up to.
why rural?
So again, it kind of goes back to this origin of in 1992, when folks were starting to push back against this homophobic measure and organize a campaign against it. Marcy noticed that a lot of the time, rural was kind of getting left out of the conversation. There was a big focus on building up support in urban areas. And that's often true just in organizing and in politics that a lot more resources go to urban areas. And so that's why Marcy and ROP to this day is really focused on rural and making sure that people are listened to and recognizing that power and continuing to build it in rural areas that are sometimes overlooked.
Let's stick with that theme for a minute, actually. It's quite common to stereotype Oregon and other places and have an urban-rural divide, and to think of rural areas as if they were somehow uniform or opposed to the kinds of principles or values that tend maybe more to predominate in the Portland metropolitan area. Rural Oregon is by no means uniform. I can, of course, attest from my own experience, but you're living that. So I know you're up against obstacles in rural Oregon that are specific to rural areas, but you're also finding, like you said, 80 different, what you call human dignity groups, 80 different groups of actually coalesced groups of people in struggle around important issues throughout the state.
Absolutely. I mean, it's certainly not uniform, and there's a lot of power to the organizing that happens in rural communities and the way that folks show up for one another when it matters. I think a particularly powerful example of that we highlight in our 30th anniversary traveling exhibit comes from Yamhill County, which is when in May of 2018, 124 people were transferred to Federal Corrections Institute Sheridan, FCI, which is a federal prison in Sheridan, Oregon. And those folks were among 1,600 who were detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, at the Mexico border, and then moved to federal prisons in five different states around the U.S. And when community members near Sheridan heard that ICE had moved people to the federal prison in their county, leadership from local organizations really quickly organized a rally in response. And what started with this 50-person protest quickly turned into the ICE Out of Sheridan Coalition, which was made up of local human dignity groups, including Unidos Bridging Community and Progressive Yamhill. And they organized interfaith vigils that brought together hundreds of people outside this prison, demanding the prison warden to end the immigration contract as soon as possible. And ultimately, that campaign was successful. And in just 6 months, Oregon became the only state to successfully win the release of 124 asylum seekers who were sent to FCI Sheridan. So that is just one of many really powerful organizing stories that I think really highlights the way that folks from across regions and across the state can come together.
Do I remember correctly that simultaneously, or maybe because of the encouragement of what was happening in Sheridan, that there also was organizing around a prison facility somewhere in the northeast of the state?
Yes, that is correct. Kind of in conjunction and then continuing on after this campaign in Sheridan, there was work to end the contract between NORCOR, a regional facility, and ICE. And that, too, was ultimately successful in ending that contract.
So some synergy, actually, organizing in one part of the state provided encouragement at the very least. I mean, it could well be that people from one place traveled to the other also, but ROP, I presume, played a big role in taking the lessons from one, taking the encouragement from one to the other.
Certainly.
That's a very important kind of role. Other stories? What other kind of campaigns?
Yeah, so the exhibit, which the full title is Bridging Divides, Defending Dignity, How Rural Oregonians Have Moved Democracy Forward Since 1992, lifts up stories from across the state to represent the full scope of ROP's network. And so In making that exhibit, we chatted with folks across the state about kind of how to celebrate this milestone. And the theme that kept coming up was how similar our current moment felt to what was going on in the 1990s when ROP came to be. And so this final product is this exhibit that is now traveling the state and lifts up stories like this one and others of powerful rural organizing. So from defeating ballot measure 9, which we've talked a bit about, to saving hundreds of rural post offices from closure, to taking action in defense of Black lives in every corner of the state. So those are just kind of a couple snippets of all of the amazing stories that are highlighted there.
Now we can Of course, have you on the air to tell the stories, but I'm curious, how does the exhibit tell stories? Are we talking about printed exhibits? We're talking about
Yeah, great
balancing
question.
art.
So the exhibit itself is yes, it's a physical thing. It's on these kind of imagine tent poles, these frames that pop up, and then you pull the sleeve that has the print of the exhibit over those poles, so they can be put up, say, like against a book stand in a library or in a community center or even in someone's home. And each exhibit tells a story or several stories from across the state and includes photos or even little archives from notes from previous road trips, things like that. So really bringing those stories to life. And then any group, anyone in any county of the state is able to host this exhibit and bring it into your community as a chance to not only reflect on these stories, but learn from them and apply them to our organizing today and talk about what similarities we see between the fights that we have and maybe what lessons learned we can bring or how they inspire us to keep fighting for human dignity and democracy.
So there might even be seminars or something along with the exhibit in some of the places.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're talking to a couple of groups to kind of form their plans for hosting the exhibit, and it's certainly whatever feels most helpful in the local context to be bringing people together and talking about local organizing. Some people choose to have kind of a more living room conversation style with people just sitting in a circle and talking things through. You can also have maybe there's someone in the community who is involved in one of these campaigns to come and speak to it, or you could host it alongside a film screening. So there are a lot of options for kind of accompanying events along with this exhibit.
Now you said you a couple of times. Are we looking for additional places? Is this addressed to our listenership?
Yes, so we're currently in the works of trying to pull together a Portland host team. So for those listening in Portland, would love to hear from anyone who's excited to learn more about the exhibit. And it's also being hosted across the state, and it's going to be traveling for our plan is at least the next year. So there's plenty of room for people to reach out about making a plan to host it.
It's exciting. I look forward to seeing it. One of the things, and one of the reasons why I'm looking forward to seeing it, one of the things I so much appreciate about ROP, Rural Organizing Project, we were talking with Sidra Pearson this morning, staff person for Rural Organizing Project. One of the things I most appreciate about the organization is its sense of history. It's from the beginning, odd as that sounds, there's been a recognition that knowing history can energize us. We can learn from history. So, you as a new staff person, were you given history lessons about ROP?
I think, yeah, there have been a lot of ways in which I've been learning the history of the organization, and part of that is just through the longstanding relationships that we have across the state. So there are folks that we've been working with and in collaboration with for as long as ROP has existed. So there's so much to be learned just from sitting down with folks and hearing those stories firsthand, and how they still carry them with them and their organizing today. And then the exhibit that we are just talking about, Bridging Divides, Defending Dignity, to get to come in and work on that as it is kind of being completed, it really lifts up so many of those stories. That was also a way that I've been continuing to learn about everything that's been done.
I want to ask you about a couple of the specific focuses that you've mentioned. One is about elections. You mentioned before some organizing around elections. What do you have in mind, or what does ROP do? Is that a matter of supporting particular candidates? Is it a matter more of just mobilizing people to get out and vote? Is it something less focused on candidates and perhaps more on issues? And are those statewide or do those tend to be local?
Yeah, great question. So we as a nonpartisan organization don't endorse candidates, but again, all of our human dignity groups are completely autonomous. So what their work looks like around the election ranges a lot. That said, a huge focus across the network every election season is just getting out and having conversations with neighbors about democracy and voting our values. And part of what we do to support that and support local groups in having those conversations every election year is we produce STAND election guides. STAND stands for Small Town Actions for a New Democracy. And so these are newsprint guides made by and for rural Oregonians to use as a tool for talking with their neighbors and to candidates to make sure we're using the power of our votes to advance democracy. And so the guides break down in plain language who can vote and how, what's on the ballot this year, the types of questions we can be asking candidates to make sure they're representing our community's values and priorities, all of that type of information. And so groups use those guides as well as their own materials around election time to do a lot of different activities, from knock and drop with the STAND election guides, or ballot parties, getting together with friends and neighbors to just go down the ballot and talk about it and break down what can be sometimes complicated language to figure out what you want to use your vote for. So that's some of what groups do around the election. We also have these STAND guides as a online version on our website at rop.org. That's available for anyone if they want to check it out, or to reach out to us to talk about how to use it to make plans to talk with neighbors this election season.
The last election, there were efforts at intimidation, were there not, in part of rural Oregon? And there was a response that I remember ROP was involved with. Can you say something about that?
In general, a lot of our groups have certainly done and continue to do work to make sure that elections feel safe and that everyone can make sure to get their vote in and make sure that it feels counted, or that it is counted. So some of those things include just making sure to be spreading really clear and true information about the election and about the voting process. Some groups have done things like observe ballot counting, just to make sure that people know that there's someone out there who cares and wants to make sure that their vote is counted. Others have done things like drive around and collect their friends and neighbors' ballots to drop them off if they don't feel safe doing so. So there's certainly a lot of actions that folks have taken on the local level to make sure that our elections are safe.
What occasioned that question was, I remember that, I think it was in Bend, that there were Proud Boy and that kind of group efforts at ballot drop-off sites trying to deter people from voting, and that there was an organized response. This, of course, was before your time here.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, the details of that story in particular.
And another thing you mentioned that interests me is, at times there are needs for responses to disasters, things like that as well, that bring people together, and that these human dignity groups are not only advocating kind of toward the future, but responding to very immediate needs. And I wondered whether you have something to say about the role of mutual aid and the way that it's carried out by some of the constituent groups in ROP.
Yes, mutual aid is definitely a focus of a lot of the groups that are part of the Rural Organizing Project. And we recently, at our Rural Caucus and Strategy session in June, we highlighted a couple of groups that have been doing really powerful rural organizing across the state and honored them with Human Dignity Awards. And we actually just sent out a newsletter sharing those stories with folks who weren't able to be at the caucus. And one of the groups that we highlighted were the Indigenous Helpers in Central Oregon. And that's a group that came out of a couple of people getting together during a particularly bad snowstorm here in Central Oregon and bringing some soup and hot beverages over to some folks who were houseless and staying outside in the storm, and that quickly spread into a mutual aid network with multiple mobile routes where they're dropping off resources, and have expanded to have a shower truck and so much more than that. So that's just one example. There are a lot of groups across the organization that are doing really important mutual aid work to provide resources and meet immediate needs.
A final big question for you, Sidra, something undoubtedly you've thought lots about. What's your vision of where the organizing goes? You talk about strengthening democracy. What do you mean by the democracy you would like to see?
So a couple of things there. One is, when we talk about democracy, it's a term that is used a lot. So I find it really important to kind of return to what that means to us. We use the World Book Encyclopedia's definition of democracy, which breaks it down into four basic principles. And those principles are, firstly, inclusion and equality for all. Second, majority rule and rights for all. Third, a well-educated and well-informed people who participate in the democratic process. And fourth, a reasonable standard of living. So I think those are really important principles to return to in terms of checking whether we are building or rebuilding democracy. And then I would also add, you know, a big part of our work is pursuing and supporting a shared standard of human dignity. And human dignity to me and to us means the belief in the equal worth of all communities, the need for equal access to justice, and the right to self-determination.
And are we moving in that direction in rural Oregon now?
I certainly think so.
You're seeing progress. You're taking encouragement from your efforts and from ROP.
Yes.
That is very good to hear. How do people find out more?
To find out more, people can go to our website at ROP.org. You can also reach out to us by emailing office@ROP.org to get connected and learn more about our work and ways to get involved. A couple of other things, you can go to ROP.org/donate to donate securely online and support this work across the state. And you can also reach out about hosting our exhibit, Bridging Divides, Defending Dignity, that we've been talking about today. We're looking in host teams across the state. And it's not too late to distribute stand election guides. So you can reach out about that as well, or go to ROP.org to find more information.
Very good job of summarizing that, how people can get in touch. Look forward to the exhibit. Again, Building Bridges, Defending Dignity, should be coming to, over the next year, to a neighborhood near you. All of our listeners should check it out. I hope that there are discussions around it, as well as just having the exhibit stand there. Sidra Pearson, it's been a great pleasure having you here this morning.
It's been so great to be here. Thanks.
And thank you then for Another World is Possible on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And here's Howard Zinn, in case you need any assistance on how to spot a communist.
In the year 1948, a series of pamphlets were distributed by the House Committee on Un-American Activities entitled 100 Things You Should Know About Communism. I came across this in my files. I keep files on them. It's only fair. I was impressed by the thought that the committee knew 100 things about communism. Where the pamphlets had 100 questions and answers. Question one, what is communism? So the idea is to start with something easy, something that requires a brief answer. Answer, a system by which one small group seeks to rule the world. The answer was probably drawn up by the people who later founded the Trilateral Commission.
Can I skip to question 76?
Where can a communist be found in everyday life? Well, this question particularly interested me because there have been times when I was in need of a communist. Didn't know where to find one. Answer, look for him in your school, your labor union, your church, or your civic club. Question 86. Is the YMCA a communist target? This is really worrying. I always wondered why there was so much chlorine in the YMCA. Answer, yes. So is the YWCA.
I mentioned earlier that we've just celebrated the centennial of Zinn's birth. At the online celebration hosted by the Zinn Education Project, Martin Espada reminisced about his friendship with Zinn. Espada's a great contemporary poet. For decades, I've kept Poetry Like Bread, Poets of the Political Imagination, the anthology he edited, right next to my own writing space. Espada began his reminiscence with a poem of his own about Zinn.
We stood together at the top of his icy steps, without a word for once, squinting at the hill below and the tumble we were about to take, heads bumping on every step till our bodies rolled into the street. He was older than the bread lines of the Great Depression. Before the war, he labored at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, even organized apprentices, but now there was ice. I outweighed him by 100 pounds. When my feet began to skid, I would land on him and hear the crunch of his surgically repaired spine. The books I held for him would fly away like doves disobeying an amateur magician. Let's go back in the house, I said. Show me the baseball Sandy Koufax signed to you from one lefty to another. Instead, he picked up a blue plastic bucket of sand, the kind of pail good for building castles at Coney Island, tossed a fist of sand down onto the sun-frozen concrete, and took the first step delicately. Again and again, he would throw a handful of sand in the air like bread for pigeons, then probe with the tip of his shoe for the sandy place on the next step. Sand, then step. Sand, then step. Every time he took a step, I took a step, an apprentice shadow studying the movements of his teacher, the body. This is how I came to dance a soft shoe in size 14 boots, grinding my toes into the gritty spots he left behind on the ice. I was there. I saw him turn the tundra into the beach with a wave of his hand. Coney Island of castles for the laborers and ball games on the radio, showing the way across the ice and down the hill into the street where he spoke to me the last words of the last lesson. You drive.
There's a lot more to that celebration of Zinn's life and contributions. You can find it at the Zinn Education Project website. To close our program, Bill Resnick returns with Jeremy Brecker of the Labor Network for Sustainability. In an earlier program, they discovered some disagreements between them. I'll let Bill introduce.
Jeremy Brecker, welcome again to KBOO.
Very good to be with you again, Bill, and very good to be with your audience. I'm so glad that they're here and engaged and concerned about these questions.
Oh boy, are they. Let me introduce you, Jeremy. You're an engaged scholar, wrote 13 books, including the book Strike, and Explore the Great Working Class of Peoples Throughout U.S. History. It's a book that has deeply influenced labor scholarship. It's a classic that he is constantly updating in new editions. More recently, you wrote the book Save the Humans, Common Preservation in Action, that discusses people power when the conditions of their life become intolerable, when they say enough, refuse to work, march, obstruct, sit down, and stand up in mass strikes. As an activist, he co-founded the Labor Network for Sustainability, that has won a great deal of union and worker support, and his vita includes many acts of civil disobedience and arrests, starting in the 1960s in support of civil rights and labor movements, and today demanding climate action by this country's leadership. Today we're going to discuss the long struggle, over 50 years now, beginning in the early 1970s, between corporate forces and the climate action movements, how that struggle has developed and is now emerging with greatly increased intensity. So, Jeremy Brecker, give us a sketch of the growing struggle as it will be updated in the next edition of your book, Strike.
Well, I'm glad you put it in the context of strike, because I think that, well, most of strike deals with what we think of as the struggles over labor issues, wages, hours, right to organize a union, and other basic labor rights. In fact, what's happening today is that protecting working people against the devastating effects of climate change is becoming and must become a central aspect of the struggle of working people for human rights and a better life. So one of the things we are seeing today, and one of the things I'm involved with, is the growing participation of workers and the labor movement in the struggle to protect the climate. And it's hardly surprising that this is happening because, first of all, working people are threatened, like everyone, by the climate emergency, but they are threatened not only in the rest of their lives, but also in their work lives and in the security of their economic situation, which is, although it's not always recognized, being heavily threatened by climate change. And so for working people, there's that extra form of threat from the emergency of climate change. Very often we're told, well, we have to make a choice between jobs and climate protection. But the reality is that climate change is the greatest threat to jobs, employment, and economic security that our country has ever known. And that for unions, they can no longer say, well, if you want to do something about climate, join an environmental organization. We have to say, and more organized groups of workers are saying, this is a labor issue, this is a worker issue. We have to become involved in standing up to the threat of climate change. And the second reason, which is getting back to your original question, is that we often find that the enemies of working people on the job, and especially in the political arena, people like the Koch brothers and other advocates of basically labor repression and eliminating all rights for working people, are also among the leading proponents of let the fossil fuel companies do whatever they want, let them pour their poisons and their climate-destroying chemicals into the atmosphere and prevent anybody, workers, environmentalists, just ordinary folks who want a future for themselves and their kids, prevent them from getting in the way and interfering with the power of the fossil fuel industry and its other allies to make profit by, as Bill McKibben said, their business plan is to destroy the planet.
On the other side of it, though, is that they recognize, my sense is many of them recognize that climate change is real, and indeed they even have to change, although of course they want to change very slowly, and time is running short. But they have a big megaphone, not because they have a movement, but because they're dominant in politics and the media. Do you see people being able to see through what is a corporate program, although the corporations haven't sat down together some kind of big meeting, a great conference, and hammered out a program saying this is what capitalism wants to do? But every industry, in fact, is now claiming to be responding. It's mostly greenwashing, but, you know, the auto industry wants to keep building cars, of course, but they're willing to do it in electric cars as long as it's done slowly so it doesn't strand their assets. Can people see through that smokescreen of capital, and are they mobilizing towards what I see as the left program that's also emerging somehow organically and not through some kind of big conference?
So certainly we are coming out of a situation in which a great deal of, well, you might say, smokescreen, giving people false ideas about what would be effective means of fighting climate change. After all, if you go back not very long, you'll find that the dominant discourse around climate change was, oh, individuals have to throw away their gum wrappers rather than burning them. People have to individually buy electric cars, and if they can't afford electric cars, well, they're bad people. Why don't they give up feeding their children and putting shoes on their feet in order to buy electric cars? A completely individualized view of what it meant to fight climate change, one that was based on the idea that people were only consumers and not either part of the political system or activists or part of communities with common interests. And I think we've gone a long way beyond that. I think most people do recognize that the needs for climate protection require a fundamental change in the entire energy system, and that that includes not only how we produce energy and that we need to shift to renewable forms of energy like wind and solar, but also that we have to find ways to use energy more efficiently, that we have to insulate our buildings, that we have to shift to non-gasoline-based vehicles. And I think that those ideas are pretty widely grasped. I think the number of people who say, well, climate change isn't real or it isn't really a threat has really diminished, and that shows both in the polls and I think in the political discourse. You can see that there aren't nearly as many politicians who are willing to say, oh, this doesn't matter, it's never going to affect you. I think when you get to the finer points, that there is a lot of deliberate smokescreen and confusion that has made it difficult for people to figure out what is effective climate protection and what is basically a way for one or another group of business people to make a buck without significantly affecting climate change. And I think in analyzing this, and we may disagree about this, and that's fine, because it's by disagreement and argument that we come to correct conclusions. So I hope if you disagree, Bill, you'll say what you think about it. But it seems to me that there is quite a range of different opinions and interests on the part of what we can broadly call the capitalist class that is quite different, both in the interests and in the policies. So first of all, even within the fossil fuel sector, there is considerable disagreement. I don't know if you or your readers noticed this, but there were big attacks in the coal industries from coal companies and their associations attacking Joe Manchin for selling them out in the interest of the oil industry, and very, very big attacks on him by the coal operators. So here we see coal has one agenda, oil has another agenda. The fossil fuel corporations as a whole have a more or less common agenda with little disagreements of that kind, and they exercise enormous influence over the rest of the business community. But I wouldn't say it's accurate to say that the corporate program for climate protection, as weak and inadequate as it may be, is the same as the fossil fuel industries. Fossil fuel industry is heavily oriented towards one thing, which is to be able to keep producing and selling fossil fuels. And for that, the core of their smokescreen lies in, for example, one of the most dubious of all climate protection policies, carbon capture, and the idea that you're going to capture the carbon in the smokestack, or even more implausible, that you're going to capture it in the open air and then turn it into something that you can burn or build houses out of or bury in the ground. This has almost no scientific support, but the companies that are specifically fossil fuel, especially gas and oil, and also to some extent coal, want to have this purported solution as a means of continuing with their business, which is producing and selling fossil fuels. The broader, let's take finance as another example, though. For finance, the attractive strategies for climate protection or pseudo-climate protection tend more to what are called market-based systems, things like cap-and-trade systems, for example, which they have made a lot of money on, especially in Europe and could hope to make a lot more money on worldwide, because they are basically the people who organize and then speculate within those so-called cap and trade systems. So my point is, you have to break it down a little bit more complexly than just saying there's a capitalist plan. There are a number of plans that different groups of capitalists are attracted to and promoting. That said, from the side of people who actually care about protecting the climate and the environment, I think what's crucial is that we develop and present a plan and an approach and a strategy for climate protection, which, first of all, is effective. Second of all, meets the interests of the wide majority of people, the working class, considered in its widest definition of basically everyone who has to work for a living, and that it can be persuasively presented as not a threat to jobs and not a threat to the economic well-being of people, but as a way to realize jobs and to realize the economic well-being of the majority of people.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. You've been listening to me, Bill Resnick, interviewing Jeremy Bricker, an engaged scholar. Multiple arrests for civil disobedience and civil rights, feminists, anti-war and anti-nuclear power struggles, among other actions. So, Jeremy, you pointed out that the oil interests and the coal interests have attacked each other. Indeed, the coal people have attacked Joe Manchin, a fellow coal millionaire, attacked him for selling out to the oil billionaires. But in the big picture, what we see are getting in Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, better called the Climate Action Act, is that both the oil and coal companies are getting large appropriations for research and development of carbon capture and sequestration. The nuclear power industry also got what it wanted. The automobile industry got big subsidies for their research and development of electric cars, and also big public subsidies for buying the cars, which really amounts to handing the car producers even more funds. And the big banks all are seeking guaranteed loans, especially for building the grids. And they're joining with the construction companies to push to build big grids across rivers and mountains and farmlands and do it on cost-plus contracts. And the small banks want guaranteed loans for homeowners installing solar panels and buying electric cars. That's not to say that the Biden plan is all bad. In fact, it includes substantial monies for the LEFT plan, which we'll talk about next week, and in particular for local community energy. Anyway, the corporate predation and going to the federal trough, that's one side of the corporate plan to line their pockets. The other side is to solidify corporate capitalism by taking no actions to change the fundamentals of their system, with growth at its heart, more production, more sales, more profits into the indefinite future. Though they offer one major exception to companies, they are promising to replace fossil fuel burning to power the economy with clean and green energy to stop greenhouse gas emissions, though that part of the plan has one caveat. It has to be done slowly because the investor-owned utilities that in the corporate plan would retain control of electricity supply. Those corporate and the investor-owned utilities do not want to strand assets like coal and gas plants until the debt used to build them is fully retired. And the big banks and finance industry that in the corporate plan would retain one of their great year-in and year-out profit centers by underwriting the bonding and investing in the debt, they also can't afford stranded and defaulted debts. And take, for example, the auto companies. They're perfectly happy to go to electric vehicles, though slowly, of course, no stranding of assets. And they will resist any effort to replace much of car driving with public transit, even resist any weight limits to the cars and SUVs and trucks. This corporate program has one notable weakness. Unlike the LEFT program that has innumerable social movements supporting it, everything from the Sierra Club to 350.org and the Audubon Society, and then many other more radical organizations, the corporate program relies on their domination of the economy, politics, and media. They use this domination to get their message across to the great public. Here is what they argue. They are committed to stopping climate change, that they, over this country's history, this is more of them, have proved themselves the innovators who get things done. These corporatists claim that you cannot depend on the dreamy left and their plan to use intermittent sun and wind energy and spread it throughout the country. The sun doesn't shine nor the wind blow all the time, they say. They argue that while we need stable, reliable energy to power this country, and our plan, while using a lot of sun and wind, will develop all other clean sources of energy, a new breed of small, safe nuclear facilities, the so-called hydrogen economy, carbon capture, even agricultural move towards soil generation to fix carbon, and the new corporate economy. These are all empty promises and profoundly misleading. But they can deluge the public, plant their propaganda in stories and newspapers and magazines, also in social media, on the internet, of course, in news, interviews, public affairs shows, and their advertising. And conservative politicians will amplify that message. In fact, they're doing it now and promote it through legislation that they will promote. At some point, maybe soon, when push comes to shove and the people must decide on which plan to support, the corporations will deluge the U.S. population in ways that make current mass advertising and presidential elections in the contested states make it appear mild and temperate.
Well, what you're saying is that if there's a capitalist program to maintain capitalism, I would find that difficult to argue with. How that plays out in terms of specific climate policies is another question.
I agree. There's all sorts of possibilities of those struggles. So, folks, with that, it's time to sign off. Jeremy Brecker will say more in part two coming up next week. He will say more on the issue of the corporate plan and their power. And then we'll discuss the superiority of the left program. And finally, next week, discuss how we can prevail, how we can both stop climate change and gain that other necessary, possible, democratic and sustainable world. In fact, I believe we can only stop climate change by building that other world. If capital, in fact, gets the authority to deal with climate change and make the necessary changes, we're doomed. They'll go very slowly. They'll predate on the economy, as in the military budget, with Raytheon, Lockheed, and all the others getting cost-plus contracts for weapon systems that they never developed, that, in fact, get canceled after the first prototype. Jeremy Brecker, writer, activist, keep up the great work.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be with you.
Thanks, Bill, with Jeremy Brecker. Thanks also to Sidra Pearson of the Rural Organizing Project, John Nelson for his editing, Patricia Kohlberg for producing today's program, and to the Zen Education Project and Martina Espada for their moving remembrance of Howard Zinn. This has been Norm Diamond. Catch us next Monday morning. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay active.
I know the future looks grim. It's a long shot and the margins are slim, but if we stand aside, we'll lose anyway. So I'll go down swinging and be able to say that there may be hope, maybe even for us. We need a lot more people raising a ruckus, start making a fuss, start giving up, and get out into the streets, and there may be hope.